Now I think I understand how Bill Clinton feels. Mitchell couldn't figure out whether to play the strong, aggressive man and make a smooth move on the waiting girl, or whether he should be the egalitarian, gentle, sensitive man who waits. Perhaps most upsetting, he really didn't know how he truly felt. Did he want to kiss her or not? Did he really like her or not? Mitchell was lucky, because his parents tried to help him with his problem. "You know," his father told Mitchell, "my new manager at work is a woman. I had a similar problem with her when she first arrived. I didn't know if I should hold open the door for her. I thought if I touched her on the shoulder, she'd sue me. I didn't know if I should ask her out for a beer. I didn't tell her any jokes, because I was afraid she might take them wrong. It took me a long time to figure these things out, and I'm still working on it." When Jennifer heard about the date, she offered an idea. "Hey, Mitchell, maybe you could just ask Liz what she thinks. Ask her if you could pay for pizza. Ask her if you could kiss her. Talk to her. I'm pretty sure she'll give you straight answers." Bolstered by this guidance, Mitchell asked Liz on another date to a rock concert. He asked Liz whether he could treat her to the event, and she accepted enthusiastically. At the end of the evening, as the two pulled into a driveway, I am told, they had no trouble agreeing that a kiss would be acceptable. So the good news is that when parents like Mitchell's show they understand how hard it is for a boy to deal with the double standard, stay involved with him, convey their empathy in a loving, thoughtful way, they not only help their son handle his confusion, but also bring the entire family closer together. We just don't talk about it. Mitchell was fortunate to have parents willing to tackle issues of sexuality. Many boys report that by the onset of puberty, they have been taught little or nothing about masculinity, dating, sex, and sexuality. Even more distressing, they feel they have no one who can understand what's happening to them and with whom they can discuss their feelings about the changes in their bodies. In one recent study, nearly half of adolescent boys ages 15 to 19 years old reported that they did not think that today's average young person receives enough information about sex and reproduction. But lack of information about sex does not prevent teenagers from engaging in it. Recent research that incorporates data from the Alan Guttmacher Institute and the National Center for Health Statistics shows that the majority of adolescents begin having intercourse by their mid to late teens. By age 18, 56% of young women and 73% of young men have had intercourse. In the early 1970s, 35% of young women and 55% of young men reported having sex by the age of 18. The percentage of those having intercourse increases from 9% for all 12-year-olds to 70% of all 18-year-olds. The bottom line is that 4 out of 5 teens have intercourse during their teen years. Only 1 out of 5 decides to wait. But even if parents are aware of these statistics, the knowledge doesn't seem to motivate them into discussing sex and sexuality. Many boys report that they feel they have to handle alone the experiences of puberty and decisions about sex. "When I had my first wet dream," 17-year-old Chad says, "I had no idea what was going on. I thought I had wet my bed. It was a really strange feeling for me. I remember liking the dream, but I felt very embarrassed. I thought maybe I had some sort of psychological problem. And who was I going to ask about it? My mother?" 16-year-old Ramon told me this story. When I moved to the United States from the Dominican Republic, I was 13 years old. I came with my mother and my older sister. My dad died when I was 6. I didn't speak any English. When I first started touching myself, I wasn't sure if it was okay. I thought maybe I was weird. I wasn't even sure why it felt so good or what would happen if I did it. There was nobody I could talk to about it. I didn't speak English, I didn't have any friends back then, and I wasn't going to talk to my mother or sister. It was really lonely, and I was worried that something was wrong with me. I thought that it was wrong and might get me or my mother into trouble somehow. I just didn't have a clue. 16-year-old Lionel told me, "Mom started working when I was about 8 years old. She just wasn't around, so I pretty much went through puberty on my own. I don't spend much time with my parents, except sometimes at night or on the weekends. But it pretty much feels like they just talk to me when they want me to do something or are angry at me." As these statements demonstrate, many boys feel that beginning at puberty and through the teen years, they don't have the kind of relationship they once had or wished they could have with their parents. Many feel distant from their parents or feel that their parents are constantly angry at them. And most seem to feel uncomfortable talking to their parents about sex and sexuality. But I believe the gulf that develops between the adolescent boy and his parents, the difficulties they have talking about sex, and the frustrations that lead the boy to perceive his parents as being distant and angry, have little to do with what parents actually want in their relationships with their sons. As one father said to me about his adolescent son, "I'd do just about anything to feel close to him again. I don't know what happened to us. Between everything that's gone on for him at school and with some of his friends, we just don't seem able to connect anymore." It doesn't have to be this way. I have found that parents and sons can have open discussions about sex and experience the kind of parent-child closeness for which they all continue to yearn if they acknowledge that they are interdependent. They need and want to be individuals, but they don't need to separate from each other. The truth is that an adolescent boy still needs his parents, and his parents still need him. If each can learn to understand the other's needs for freedom without disconnection, I believe that much of the silence around sex could be replaced with lively dialogue, and much of the pain and isolation felt by our boys who are about to become men could be significantly reduced. What happens when we don't talk about it? The specter of drugs. When we don't talk about the issues that are bothering our teenage boys, when we force them to separate rather than supporting them as they learn to individuate, they may retreat behind the mask so completely and consistently that it becomes hardened and fixed in place. They may, in fact, find themselves unable to remove the mask, and just as Mitchell couldn't determine how he really felt about Liz, they may lose touch with their own genuine feelings. The mask makes it difficult for parents and sons to talk openly about sex and sexuality. What's worse, as we'll see, it may make a boy more likely to take risks with alcohol and drugs. And because the mask makes it appear that everything is fine, it may prevent parents from seeing or accepting that a boy is in fact already taking those risks. But whether parents see it or not, many teenagers are involved with drugs. According to the recent National Longitudinal Study on Adolescent Health, a large-scale nationwide demographic study of adolescents' physical and mental health, In addition to the over 25% of adolescents who are current cigarette users, nearly 10% of students report that they drink alcohol at least one day a week, and nearly 18% say they drink more than once a month. While over a quarter of the adolescent students in this study reported having smoked marijuana at least once, more than 12% said they smoked it at least once during the previous month. In studies that look at what teenagers say other teenagers are doing with drugs, the statistics are even more disturbing. For instance, in a 1997 study conducted for the Commission on Substance Abuse Among America's Adolescents by the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University, 56% of teenagers said they knew someone who used cocaine, heroin, or LSD, up from 39% in 1996. Among the 12-year-olds involved in this study, 23.5% of them said they knew friends or fellow students who had used these hard drugs. Other statistics reported in connection with this major study include the fact that among eighth graders, heroin use doubled from 1991 to 1996. Also among eighth graders, binge drinking, i.e. drinking continuously to get drunk, went from 12.8% in 1992 to 15.6% in 1996. The study noted, too, that teenagers who smoke, drink, or use marijuana, the so-called gateway drugs, are 17 times more likely to move on to harder, more dangerous drugs, and stressed that boys taken alone are 29 times more likely to move on to such substances, whereas girls are 11 times more likely. Many boys use drugs and alcohol simply to numb the pain of their emotions, the disconnection they feel from their parents, their low self-esteem, their problems at school, with peers, or with their budding sexuality. Some boys turn to drugs like marijuana or cocaine in a vain attempt to ease the pain of being an adolescent, to escape its perils and confusions, to help them slip off the mask and rebel against society's old boy code rules about how boys should be and about what is or isn't masculine. Relying on this ungenuine, drug-induced sense of emotional safety, they feel more comfortable revealing what they are truly experiencing inside, especially the love, affection, and need for connection they feel for others. "I love you, man." The problem, of course, is that drugs and alcohol present only short-term and illusory relief from a boy's worries and cares. When the intoxication wears off, the boy retreats behind the mask, the straitjacket tightens, and he begins to repress his true self once again. And now he's added dependence on substances in order to feel real. Drugs and alcohol solve none of the root problems and bring with them a whole raft of new difficulties and risks. Inability to function academically, depression, low self-esteem, being shunned by non-drinking peers, injuries and accidents, dropping out of school, and more. A disconnection for the parents. For parents and caregivers, dealing with the mask is tough enough. When the boy turns to drugs and alcohol to help him remove it, the relationship becomes even more challenging. Parents are often taken by surprise when the boy who used to be so open and willing to talk seems to have disappeared. Many parents tell me they feel disconnected from and rejected by their sons or confused by a boy's outward rigidity or irreverence. "He's acting like such a macho little idiot, never talking to me anymore about anything that matters," one parent said, referring to her 16-year-old son. I just feel like telling him, you used to be so nice, and now you've become a big block of ice. Why don't you just snap out of it and get real? Or, as another parent put it, every afternoon my boy comes home, throws his stuff in his room, and then heads off to hang out with his friends at a local park. I really suspect he's doing drugs. Sometimes when he comes home, he looks really tired and rushes off to be alone in his room. But given how distant and angry he seems these days, it doesn't seem worth it to say anything because he'll probably just get even madder and storm off by himself. As natural as it may be sometimes to feel like giving up and just let a boy do as he pleases, it simply doesn't work. In my years of counseling adolescent boys and their parents, I've learned that it's always better to be there, to say to your son, as Abraham did, "Here I am." As parents, we simply must hang in there for our sons, because the risks involved in giving up are too great. We may be forced to deal with drugs, depression, AIDS, violence, and all the rest. It's critical that we let our boys know that as much as we respect their need to individuate, they will always be welcome at home. That as much as they may want to wear a mask of protection in the outside world, they can take it off at home or in other safe spaces. We must let our sons know that we will be there, and we'll always do our best to provide a place they can return to for love, warmth, and reconnection. We have to help them understand that it is only through the potency of connection, and certainly not drugs or alcohol, that the adolescent years can become a time when a solid self takes shape and when the real boy starts to become a real and successful man. As Robert Frost understood so well, home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in. The peer pressure cooker. Even when parents encourage a boy in his fight to individuate, his peers may not be so supportive. When he first begins to spend time with his peers, the adolescent boy may feel he's entered a whole new universe with its own rules and language. "When I got to middle school," one boy explained, "everything changed. Kids I used to be friends with, who were just nice guys, suddenly started acting cool. By seventh grade, a few of them started to drink and smoke. They were totally different from when I knew them in elementary school. You knew that if you didn't act the same way, you'd be an outcast from that group." Or, as another boy put it, "once you're 13 or older, you can't be the same person at school as you are at home. It's not considered cool." Their peers will also reproach or reject them if boys act in ways that appear feminine or that could possibly suggest homosexuality. As a result, boys begin to harden themselves and to avoid any person or situation that might bring them shame. Perhaps an adolescent boy suffers his greatest humiliation when he violates the boy code. As 15-year-old Ken explains, "I think there is a thing that boys should be tough and mean, and I think that is a little ridiculous because some people are tough, but some people aren't. There are girls that are tough, and just because you are a boy doesn't mean that you have to be the strongest kid in the world or the tough guy." Or, as 14-year-old Ian expressed it, "You've got to really keep your guard up. If you don't, the guys will call you a dork and tell people that you're not cool." This code to be cool can also push younger adolescents into dangerous and self-destructive behavior. One boy explained, "At parties, I've seen the cool kids try to influence the other kids to drink. They say that if those kids don't drink, then they can't hang out with them." One of the saddest consequences of the boy code is the creation of such pressure on a boy to mask his true identity that he loses touch with who he is and what really brings him joy in life. To ensure that he'll be seen as cool, the boy may avoid acting in certain ways, expressing certain emotions, or engaging in certain activities that aren't deemed appropriate anymore. In other words, by purposely changing his behavior to avoid the embarrassment of violating the boy code, he completely sacrifices his genuine self. "My sister and I used to have jump rope contests," says 12-year-old Stuart. "But then I started to get teased and stopped. It wasn't worth it anymore." 15-year-old Lionel told me, "I used to talk a lot, you know, about whatever was happening, whatever I was doing. But at school now, if you talk too much, people tell you to shut up. Like the guys who act tough and don't say much are the ones the girls all go for. So now, at school, I try not to say much. At home, I talk my brother's ear off." "I think it was when I turned 11, 17-year-old Jake recalled. "Guys just started ranking on each other and picking on the little ones. If you wore some stupid shirt, that was it. Everybody would try to do you in. My dad works at a newspaper, so he would always encourage me to keep a journal at home, sort of like a diary. I liked it, because I would write about people and stuff that happened and how I really felt about it. But when things started changing at school, I stopped writing in my journal. I was afraid someone might find it, and then I'd be in real trouble." During adolescence, boy code rules are strictly enforced, and the division between those who fit the mold and those who don't can be extremely rigid. Not only can it make the boy disconnect from his genuine self, but it can actually undermine and even destroy his closest friendships. Matt and Zachary, a friendship broken by the code. Matt Green, an articulate 15-year-old, told me a particularly poignant story about how the boy code can push boys apart. In elementary and junior high school, Zachary Miller was Matt's best friend. When they entered high school, Matt and Zachary began to drift away from each other. "Zachary does theater and likes to dress in weird clothes," Matt explained. "He couldn't care less about sports. He doesn't watch TV. He doesn't date girls or go to dances. All that might be okay, but he's really sensitive about everything. When kids give him grief, he doesn't know how to respond. He gets flustered and mad. I like him a lot, but a lot of kids think he's a fag and couldn't believe I would hang out with him." Matt found it tough to keep his other friends and stay associated with Zachary. "I think I could have stuck with him if he had dealt with the flack better, but one day he went to the teacher when some kid stole his hat and wouldn't give it back. He should have laughed it off or punched somebody or done something for himself, but he turned red and walked away." What would it take to repair the relationship? "I don't care if Zachary is into theater or wears purple pants. No one does, really. What matters is that he has to find a way to be himself and deal with everybody else, too," Matt says. "I feel bad about it. I still say hi to him in the hall and everything, but I just can't be his friend right now. If I do, people will definitely get on my case." Some boys resist peer pressure and fight back. One of the most heartening findings of my Listening to Boys' Voices study is that many of the boys I interviewed revealed an eagerness to resist the kind of peer pressure that caused Matt and Zachary to split, to come out from behind the mask and to challenge the shame-inducing boy code. For some boys, This means creating a safe space where they can all feel free to be themselves. For instance, in Chapter 4, we talked about Jason, who set up a guy's place at school where boys with differing personalities and interests could come together to talk about feelings and issues and form new friendships. Isaiah, a savvy 16-year-old, offered this advice to younger boys. Just be yourselves and don't do anything you don't want to, because in the long run, if you're acting false, hanging out with kids that you don't really like, it's not really worth it. You're only young once. You should do what you want and have fun, because that's the way you're going to be happy. You have to be yourself. John, another teenage boy in the study, explained, "There are certain things that boys are supposed to be good at. Boys are supposed to play sports. Boys are supposed to want to make it with girls. Boys are supposed to drink beer. But lots of guys aren't that way. Lots of guys are into computers. Some guys like to draw. A lot of guys are into music. Many guys do volunteer stuff, or like to hike and camp. I think the stereotypes are wrong. Whatever a person does should be respected. I don't think a boy should have to play sports at all if he doesn't want to. I think he should do what he wants." In a similar vein, 16-year-old Aaron had an impressively sophisticated understanding of gender straitjacketing and the problem of boys calling one another names like fag or wimp. "A few of my friends act like you have to be homophobic to prove that you're not gay. You have to say you hate gay people so that everyone will know you're definitely not gay and think you are okay." At first, Aaron confessed, he and others of his friends participated in the taunting. But then one of his buddies, Bobby, introduced him to a different perspective. "Bobby is the best athlete and a great kid. Everyone loves him and respects him. Bobby isn't gay, but he told me it was wrong to trash gay people. He said being gay is normal. Why should we make fun of them?" It got me thinking. He is exactly right. Aaron concluded, "Now I try to pass the message along. I tell people that gay bashing is stupid. The more people who say that, the more people will get the message and cut it out." Indeed, boys like Isaiah, John, Aaron, and Bobby sense that there's something wrong with being forced to act in one stereotypical masculine way and show that they are willing to take a stand to change how society pushes them to accept a gender straitjacket. But resisting society's code of masculinity is not easy. The boys in my study reported that they have to be cautious about how they go about it. "I pick my battles," Aaron explained, meaning that he was careful to take on issues that he felt wouldn't risk putting him in a bad place with his peers. "Keeping up good relations with one's peers matters a lot to adolescent boys. Many boys report that having close friends, boys and girls, who will support them and their good name, and who will stand up for them if they take a risk by challenging the boy code, makes all the difference in the world. In dealing with peer ridicule and mustering the courage to take on the code, boys emphasize that what helps them most is knowing that their friends and their families will stand by them." The public and private selves, a boy split in two. The disparity between how a boy privately wishes to behave and how he feels he must behave when he is in public may surprise and confuse him. He feels confused that the way he can act at home when he's among his family and closest friends is often different from how his peers expect him to behave. What works in the privacy of his home may not fly in public peer settings. As the boy quoted earlier said, You can't be the same person at school as you are at home. The schoolyard culture of cool or tough and the family room culture of openness and authenticity often clash. The private self, the self that the boy genuinely is within, the self that is reinforced by female peers and often at home by mothers and fathers, may wish to act friendly, be playful and loving, and show a broad range of emotions. But then there is also the pull from society in general, from peers and especially from other boys, to act strong, athletic, taciturn. Boys are called upon to avoid showing even a trace of vulnerability. When the pressure becomes too much, some boys will take extreme measures, teasing others, spray-painting graffiti on school lockers, even assaulting another student to acquire a reputation for being cool and win the kinship and respect of their compatriots. Navigating between the Scylla of respect others' needs, stay in connection, and the Charybdis of chill out, be your own man, our modern-day Odysseus is likely to falter at the shoals of one extreme or another, striving to master his confusion, frustration, and longing. My research shows that during adolescence, boys voice their desire to remain true to their inner values, to refuse to numb or hollow out their inner voice, while still saving face at school and on the basketball court. For instance, 17-year-old Scott Adams told me about the pressure at school to fight with other boys and how he dealt with it in light of what his parents taught him about fighting. "The worst time I ever had," he started, "was when I was fighting over Sharon with Doug Santos. Sharon was dating Doug, but decided to go out with me, too. Doug, who's really popular, got very mad. One day, Doug and a bunch of other guys from his neighborhood surrounded me at school in the parking lot, with Sharon right there. His pals started shouting, 'Come on, Doug, hit Scott, hit him. He can't fight anyway.' So what did you do?" "I tried to never get involved in physical stuff. My mother always told me to use my words, but not my hands. So I told Doug I didn't want to fight. I told him I thought we could talk the problem out." "That was a great response," I volunteered. Scott rolled his eyes. "No, it wasn't. Doug started shoving me around, saying, 'You fucking creep, you little fag. Come on, let's see you fight.' So then what?" "Well, there was no teacher around, and I've never really learned how to box or anything. But I just took the hardest swing I could and hit Doug. I guess I got him in just the right spot, because he let out a cry and doubled over, then kind of limped away. His friend started saying, 'Whoa, Adams, all right. You got him pretty good.'" "Did you tell your parents?" "Yeah, they found out. My mother started lecturing me, but my father just sort of smiled. I feel confused about it, though. I don't think I did the right thing. Mom doesn't think I did the right thing, but Dad thinks it was kind of funny. And Doug never bothered me again." This conflict between public and private behavior can lead to far more serious results than a minor skirmish in a school parking lot. Research shows that boys who are split in two are more at risk developing learning disabilities, severe depression, and impulsive and compulsive behaviors that range from substance abuse to unsafe sex, from acting out in the classroom to committing suicide. My own study demonstrates that although boys actually work hard to become whole, to resist betraying the inner boy, and to experience vulnerable and painful feelings, they do so under terrible strain to look good in front of their peers, to wear their mask. You're misunderstood if you act tough. It seems that whatever model a boy chooses to follow at any given time, the macho man or the sensitive one, is likely to get him into trouble with somebody. When boys display the kinds of cool, tough behavior they thought society expected of them as young men, adults, especially their parents, reprimand them for seeming distant, rough, or unfeeling. In other words, just when they manage to adopt the behaviors they thought were required of them, many boys find that, far from being admired for their manly comportment, they are actually rebuffed or rebuked. As a result, adolescent boys often feel on the defensive, sensing that others see them as insensitive, violent, uncaring. They don't understand why adults seem so disappointed in them when they're trying so hard to behave in the ways they thought everyone was telling them they should. 16-year-old Ross relates it this way. Being a guy today, wow, you don't know when you are going to offend someone. You've always got to be watching yourself. Is this going to get this person upset? And is that going to get that person upset? So being a guy, it seems like I'm the enemy to society. The double standard puzzles and angers thoughtful young men like Craig, a graduating high school senior. On the one hand, his peers expect him to be unflinching. It's basically what this whole school's about. You try to act like the tough guy. In a sports game, or if someone takes you down, you don't back down. You step toward him, Craig observes. In other contexts, Craig feels targeted for being a male teenager who may appear too tough. People act like guys my age are up to no good half the time, Craig contends. Craig related two recent examples. I went to the bank this past weekend, and because I didn't have my bank book with me, they doubted my identity. Would they have done that if I was a girl? I don't think so. They went through a whole list of questions of who my parents were, what street I lived on, and how old I was. After a while, I was like, why are you still doubting me? Have I done something wrong? They figured that a guy who's a teenager is probably up to no good somehow or other. Another time, I was about to pull out of a parking lot by Fenway Park after a Red Sox game, and a police officer waved me to stop. I pulled over, and I think just because I was a guy and I'm a kid, he went through a whole list of questions. He asked if I had any warrants out for my arrest or anything like that, and I thought that was kind of unusual that he would do that for no reason. I don't think that would happen to a girl, either. You're misunderstood if you act nice. Boys can also run into trouble when they try to act empathic, gentle, and connected, to behave, in other words, in the ways that feminist teachings have advocated as healthy and important. With all the feminist ideas in the country and the equality, I think guys sometimes get put on the spot, 16-year-old Toby said. Guys might do something that I think or they think may not be wrong at all, but they still get shot down for it. If you're not nice to a girl, she thinks you don't care. But if you are nice, she thinks you're treating her too much like a lady. Girls don't understand guys, and guys don't understand girls very well. I asked Toby to give me an example from his own experience. For instance, my ex-girlfriend came to one of our basketball games the other day. After the game, I went and said hi to her and some other friends. Someone told me later that just as I was turning to say hi to somebody else, she started to give me a hug. I didn't even know she did it, but she thought I was ignoring her and being a jerk. But you know that if I had hugged her first, she would have been mad at me for doing something she didn't want. Instead, she ended up mad at me for not hugging her, even though I didn't know what was going on. It's a confusing subject because it's just that everyone is different and everyone perceives things differently. Sometimes they want us to be manly or something, but sometimes they don't want us to be manly. You can't really tell how one girl is going to react to certain things. It may be completely different than another girl's reaction. Girls want you to be sensitive and everything, but guys call you a fag or a wimp if you act certain ways. Like in my case, I respect all my teachers, I respect adults, and I am always polite, because that is the way I have been brought up. But a lot of the times, my friends say I'm kissing ass or being a brown nose just because I'm being polite and I talk to adults. I say I'm just being polite, and they say, oh no, you're a wuss. It bothers me. So what should I be? How should I behave? Much of my recent research project consisted of extensive interviews with boys from which many of these comments were taken. But I also gave a series of psychological tests to 150 boys from the ages of 12 to 18. The survey included two tests that enabled me to ascertain boys' conscious and unconscious attitudes about the way a boy should go about becoming a man and the ways in which they believed a healthy man should act in our society. The first group of boys I surveyed was composed of urban kids from a mid-sized city on the eastern seaboard, so I suspected that they would convey a fair amount of sophistication about equality for men and women, boys and girls. Indeed, my suspicions were correct. On a test called the Sex Role Egalitarianism Scale, created by King and King, these boys scored well within the range of men and women who embrace the new masculinity. This means that they endorsed such statements as men and women should be given an equal chance for professional training, and courses in home management should be as acceptable for male students as for female students, and strongly rejected such notions as the husband should be the head of the family, or it is more appropriate for a mother rather than a father to change a baby's diapers. Here there were no surprises, only confirmation that boys appear to be breaking out of gender rigidities into a new model of manhood, a model that is more open to men doing things and behaving in ways traditionally thought of as more feminine than masculine. But then I did something a bit unusual. In the past, most research has been either-or. Either it has focused on the progress boys have made toward gender equality by using the sex role egalitarianism scale or a similar test, or it has analyzed how boys support or reject the characteristics associated with traditional masculinity. In other words, most studies have tested their subjects on just one attribute, where they fall on the scale as regards gender equality. Are they egalitarian or non-egalitarian? Or how much they adhere to traditional ideals of masculinity? But my own theory, that boys are being pushed to be both egalitarian and traditional, led me to take a different approach. I wondered what we would discover if we tested them on both characteristics. So in addition to testing the boys on the sex role egalitarianism scale, we also tested the same group of boys on Plek's traditional male role attitude scale. By giving the same boys both tests, my research approach allowed for parallel measures rather than an either-or choice. The results of this approach showed that the same boys who endorsed the egalitarian values were equally strong when they took the traditional male role attitude scale. They supported the following statements. I admire a guy who is totally sure of himself. It is essential for a guy to get respect from others. A man always deserves the respect of his wife and children. It bothers me when a guy acts like a girl. And men are always ready for sex. So when given the opportunity to bare their souls, these adolescent boys, without knowing it, revealed an inner fissure, a split in their sense of what it means to become a man. On a test that measures their openness to egalitarian ideas, they embraced being egalitarian. On a test that measures how traditional they are about masculinity, they hold on to a number of traditional traits. These results point directly to boys' inner unconscious confusion about what society expects of them as males. Because society requires boys to be both traditional and egalitarian, boys are unable to internally consolidate their feelings of masculinity. If they feel consistent and clear about their masculinity, boys would tend to test high on the traditional scale and low on the egalitarian, or high on the egalitarian scale and low on the traditional. But by scoring high on both of these diametrically opposed traits, boys revealed profound inner turmoil. As we will see in Chapter 10, where I will discuss my research on these boys' self-image and how it relates to how well they do at school, this turmoil manifests itself in a growing need to mask their insecurities and an increasingly fragile sense of self-esteem. Specifically, as boys move through adolescence, my research shows that they are more and more prone to distort the extent to which they truly feel confident about their masculinity. More and more, they feel they need to say they conform to society's ideal of masculine self-confidence, even though inside themselves they may not feel confident at all. The painful prospects of manhood. Perhaps largely because of this festering internal confusion, many adolescent boys appear to feel deeply ambivalent about growing up to be men. If they're not sure what it means to be a man, I wonder, how could they possibly look forward to adulthood? As part of my research, I decided to explore what boys are really feeling about becoming grown men. Discovering this is not easy, of course, because, as we've seen, boys tend to bury their deepest, most painful feelings. One technique that psychologists use to discover the emotions that a person is experiencing subconsciously, or is actually suppressing, is to show him or her cards with illustrations of people in various emotionally charged situations specifically designed to evoke such feelings, and then ask the person to express what he or she sees happening in the particular illustration. In my recent research, I showed boys two such cards and then asked them to write a story about the main character in each picture while concentrating on their feelings. Loosely modeled on a common psychological assessment instrument called the TAT, or Thematic Apperception Test, developed decades ago by Henry Murray, I used this approach to develop a window into each boy's hidden thought processes, a window through the mask. What I discovered is that many boys feel profound anxiety about their future as men. How boys view a man's work. One of the pictures that evoked the most potent responses was a black-and-white sketch of a man dressed in a white shirt and tie, obviously at work, poring over his papers. In the sketch, he is sitting at a desk with a neutral expression on his face, gazing vaguely in the direction of a photograph on his desk of a woman and two children, one a boy and one a girl, that could represent his family. Listen to 17-year-old Hamilton's story about what we must take to be his expectation of following the rules in growing up male. "This guy," he told us, "is sick of working, and he doesn't want to deal with his job or family anymore. He is thinking about what his life would be like if he hadn't married, and how much it sucks to work all the time. He wishes he could leave and be by himself and have fun, but he'll work for 25 more years, hate it, and then retire. The kids will move out, and he'll realize his life was dull and boring. He'll be old then, and what will he have to show for all this? Not much." Hamilton's gloomy tale evokes the depressing, emotionally draining role of the male workhorse, connected to family but disconnected from self. It brings to mind those dray horses that were still around in circuses when I was a child, dragging appallingly heavy loads, wearing blinders, and lumbering for mile after mile with a sense of disgruntled regularity and depressing inevitability. Tragically, Hamilton's caricature is not terribly different from the profile of the disillusioned middle-aged male executives I'm asked to counsel when their suicide plans have failed and they've been hospitalized against their will. Ninth-grade Roger, rather than focusing on the intensity of a man's workday, hit upon the ways that professional obligations can separate men from family and erode their most important relationships. This is the story of a man, construction worker, looking at blueprints, who was divorced by his wife. Now he is staring at the picture and thinking about his family and how he can get them back. He was probably divorced because he worked too late at night and was never home. Eighth grader Bruce had a similar reaction. A man is at work looking at his family. Maybe he was lonely or missing his family because they were killed or he was divorced. Maybe he will rescue them. As these remarks reflect, though boys still seem to feel hope, it's tempered by a fear that once they become men, work pressures could eventually keep them far from the emotional, intimate world of their families. Adolescent boys, my research shows, are deeply ambivalent about becoming men and dealing with the responsibilities, limitations, and loneliness that appear to go with adulthood. Adolescent themes about men's work. In analyzing the responses of the boys interviewed, I found the results could be divided into at least 5 thematic categories, one of which reflected positive emotions, and the rest dwelling on the impending pain in becoming burdened with the adult role of men at work. A happy, contented family man. 15% of the boys told stories that fell into this first and only positive category. These boys saw a happy, contented family man daydreaming at work. They said things such as, "This is John, and he is an engineer doing quite well at work. Right now he's taking a short break because he's had a hard day. And daydreaming about his family. Soon his day will be done, and he'll be home with his wife and kids. This man is getting satisfaction that he is able to support his wife and kids." The lonely, career-oriented male provider. 35% of the boys told stories that fell within the second thematic category. They viewed the depicted character as a father fulfilling the requisite career-oriented male provider role, a role they saw as leading to autonomy, but also to temporary separation from family. They offered the following narratives. "He's on a business trip, and so he's missing his family. He has to be apart from them. He had to work overtime quite late to make more money, so he's missing his family. The architect is looking at the picture of his family, worrying about making enough money to support his 2 children and help them through college." The alienated breadwinner. Those subjects whose stories were in the third category, about 24% of the boys, saw a father who, by fulfilling his role as a breadwinner, had become alienated from friends and family. Unlike boys from the group directly above, these boys were explicit about the unhappy aspect of having to fulfill this role. For instance, a man at work, looking at a picture of his family. He misses them terribly because work is taking up all his time. His wife wants more attention. He wants to spend more time with the kids, but he can't. He is feeling depressed and can't get it off his mind. Maybe he'll try to ask for time off. He's not completely hopeless. He loves his family very much, but has to work to support them, therefore doesn't spend enough time with them, feels guilty. The loser. About 21% of the boys described a father who had suffered some loss, a death in the family or a similar tragedy, or who was somehow cut off from his family through divorce or otherwise. Most of these boys portrayed the father as feeling vulnerable, as seeking reconciliation and reconnection. Listen, for example, to this story. He's looking at his family's picture at work. He feels very lonely. Maybe they were killed, or he was divorced. He wants his family back. Maybe he will try to save them or rescue them. He worked too much, and the judge took away his family. He's very sad. He wishes he had a second chance. He'll try to get his family back. Alan is staring at the picture, thinking how lucky he had once been having a family. Because he was away at work, the mother was driving while drunk, and she and the kids were all killed. He's overwhelmed with grief and wishes he had his family back. The permanently separated man. Finally, some of the boys we interviewed, about 5%, told a tale of a father who, beyond his control, had become permanently separated from his family. In some cases, the boys told the story in a neutral way, while in other instances, for example, the story of 12-year-old Jamie, they linked it to deep feelings of pain and longing. Bill is staring at a picture of his family who had to leave him. He is writing them a letter, telling them how much he misses them, yearns to be with them again, expressing all his feelings. He says, "I hope we can meet again, live together again, so I can show you all my love." Harry is looking at the people whom he loved. They have died, and he is agonizing over what he could have done to save them. He wants to move on, but he can't. He will probably need to see a doctor for his problems. The feeling I get is that this man is lost, is far away from his family. He's in some kind of pain, maybe regretting the loss of the custody of his children. With the limited exception of those in the first category, most of these boys appeared to be telling stories related to separation, isolation, and loneliness. I believe that these boys are reporting how they themselves feel and how they view their fathers and other male figures in their lives. They are also describing memories of how they felt when they were prematurely disconnected from their mothers and early caretakers. They are expressing the longings they may still feel as adolescents about the difficulty of maintaining close relationships with parents and other close relatives, longings for connection they suppress to conform with society's code of masculinity. And that they are telling us indirectly, "I am afraid. I'm not ready to become a man and go to work. I am not ready to be cut off from my friends and family." How boys view themselves. These feelings of anxiety and these hidden yearnings for connection and the deep sense of loss and loneliness that goes with them also became evident when we analyzed the boys' responses to the second picture we gave them to consider. This second picture, is an actual photograph of a young blond-haired boy sitting by himself at the threshold of an open doorway of an old wooden house. The sun casts generous light upon the boy and the front of the house, but a dark shadow covers whatever is beyond the open door inside the house. The boy is perched alone at the edge of the door, his elbows on his knees, his chin cupped in both hands. His expression is difficult to interpret. He appears to be concentrating, or perhaps the sun is just causing him to squint a bit. In interpreting this second picture, adolescent boys again told stories that fell into five major thematic categories. While the first two categories were neutral, focused on developmental themes that did not involve particularly positive or negative emotions, the three other categories, like most of those related to the first image, emphasized a sense of intense loss. A boy in transition. Boys who told stories that fell into the first category, about 13%, struck up themes of transition. They recounted things such as a boy who was about to move from one place to another. This boy is captured by the photographer while he is waiting to go somewhere. He's waiting for someone. A contemplative boy. About 27% of the boys told stories in the second category that involved themes of contemplation. The boys reported that a small boy is sitting on a stoop, thinking about something, mulling over a serious matter in his head. This is a boy who is thinking very hard. He's sitting and sorting out his thoughts. He just wants to sit and think in the shade. An abandoned boy. Boys whose stories fell into the third category emphasized abandonment. 24% of the boys questioned explored these themes. For instance, this boy has been left alone and is waiting for his loved ones to return. Arnie is a very young child sitting alone and abandoned in a doorway, starving. His parents abandoned him. His only wants are food and love. Will he die alone on the street? His parents skipped town and left him behind. He'll end up in foster homes. A little boy lost and abandoned. His family lacked money, so they abandoned him. He is scared and lonely. He wants someone to love and care for him. He might get adopted. The boy is sitting depressed and disappointed. He just pitched a no-hitter, and his dad wasn't there to see him. All the other guys' dads seem to be there. Dad will apologize, but nothing will change. Missing his mother, crying for her. The isolated boy. The fourth category involved stories of isolation, 19% of our subjects. It's a boy, alone and sad. A young boy sitting by himself, a sense of loneliness, very serious. This boy is lonely, no friends to be with. He is crying and sad by himself. The boy as victim. Boys in the final category saw the boy depicted as a victim, and about 17% interpreted the picture this way. A boy whose father has been correcting him over and over. The boy isn't liking his father. This boy was accused of doing something wrong, and his father took off his belt and hit him numerous times, and he will be emotionally scarred for life. The dad is drunk and beating him and his mom. This is a boy who has been beat and neglected, has no mother and no one to comfort him. He'll avoid people now. John was just abused and ran away to this cabin to avoid the abuser. He's very depressed. Suicide is going through his mind. As these anecdotes suggest, for many adolescent boys, Making the passage from boyhood to manhood is fraught with profound feelings of inner pain. A boy contemplates his fate all alone. He's restless, he's lonely. He feels abandoned, perhaps stranded by his parents. He is frightened, and he fears he may be injured unjustly or be prone to depression or suicidal feelings. These are the voices of our boys, terribly afraid about becoming men. My research results do not stand alone. For instance, in a national survey of teenagers for the Horatio Alger Association in 1996, many more girls than boys were able to imagine that happiness is what they wanted most from life. 32% of girls, but only 23% of boys. And when asked about future plans, 67% of the girls expected to attend a four-year college, compared with only 54% of the boys. As 15-year-old Calvin told us in Chapter 2, society's expectations of adolescent boys are not just based on a double standard. They are often inhumane. I guess it's hard being a guy, because there are so many things that a normal person would do that you are not allowed or expected to do. Or, to borrow the phrase one Native American tribe uses to characterize its own manhood initiation rites, for many boys, adolescence is the big impossible. Connection can overcome the problems of the second trauma, just as it can the first. I have found that what boys need most to conquer the big impossible, to survive the peer pressure, gender straitjacketing, and the other tribulations of adolescence, is knowing that they have meaningful connections not only with their friends, but also with their parents and other family members. Although we are often taught that adolescents, especially male adolescents, need or want to separate from their families, this is another dangerous myth about boys. Certainly, adolescents are struggling with issues of identity and growth, and will push at us, even push away from us at times. Certainly, they wish to spend some time away from home and develop an individual sense of self. But our sons rarely wish to cut their ties, be on their own, or to separate from us. In fact, most of our boys desperately need their parents, the family, and the extended family, coaches, teachers, ministers, rabbis, to be there for them, stand firm yet show flexibility, and form a living wall of love that they can lean on and bounce off. It's not separation, but rather individuation that they want. It's becoming a more mature self in the context of loving relationships, stretching the psychological umbilical cord rather than severing it, that healthy male adolescence is all about. My research shows that our boys know this only too well. Seth, in describing how he copes with the separation pain many boys experience, replied buoyantly, "I think it's just the closeness of my family, the way my parents have brought me up to want to be part of the family. I love going home and spending time with my mom or my dad. I'd have no problem going and spending the whole weekend with my family rather than going to spend the weekend with my friends," Seth explained. "Sometimes I'd rather be with my family. When I'm with my friends, sometimes I'd say I'd rather be home." For the adolescent boy, knowing that he has a loving home and that he can tap into the strength derived from positive family relationships is truly key to making it through adolescence. In my research, again and again, boys refer to the importance of family. I firmly believe that it's the potency of family connection that guards our adolescent boys from emotional harm and gives them the most reassurance in the adolescent world of cool. Other psychologists, too, have corroborated the central role of family connections during adolescence. Feldman and Wentzel from Stanford University found that the perception boys have of their parents' marital satisfaction directly affected their social adjustment during adolescence. Blake Bowden of the Cincinnati Children's Hospital found that adolescents who shared dinners with their families 5 times a week were least likely to use drugs or be depressed, and most likely to excel at school and have a healthy social life. Likewise, the recent National Longitudinal Study on Adolescent Health found that what affected adolescent behaviors most were social contexts, especially the family. According to the study, parent-family connectedness dramatically influences the level of emotional distress adolescents suffer.